go forward. Our next speaker is Chuck Perreault. We thank you for coming from Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center at Chapel Hill. He's been a very active, prominent figure in this field for a long time, and specifically worked on breast cancers and triple-negative breast cancer signatures. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. So today, I'll talk a bit about the analytical validation of assays. But actually, I'm going to spend a little more time on what I think is some of the bigger picture issues here. So, standard disclosure slide. Of course, the disclosure relevant for this talk is we are trying to develop a commercial version of our intrinsic subtyping assay. Today, I won't present any data on that commercial version. And everything I'm going to be talking about is in the research setting. And that's a very important distinction. There we go. Oh, it makes it a little harder for me to see, but I guess I got it right here. Or here, we move the mic that way. There we go. How's that? Excellent. So I've been doing genomics now for more than a decade, right? And it started with this paper in the Botstein and Brown lab. And one of the first really, I think, shocking findings to us and possibly everyone was the reproducibility of the assay and the individuality of different tumors, right? So in this hierarchical cluster diagram here, we had 22 tumors pairs, 20 before and after chemotherapy, and two tumor lymph node metastasis pairs. Was it 17 of the 22 grouped together, right? And this sort of gave rise to the term molecular portraits, right? Every tumor is an individual, and actually this technology was able to see that individuality with, I'll argue, high reproducibility. And this finding, I will argue, has continued to this day, where if you have repeated samplings of the same tumor, they continue to group right next to each other the majority of the time. And so getting to the goals of the committee, it almost seems like there's, in some ways, two sets of goals, right? One is to try and define some of these analytic and performance variables. And I think many of the other speakers today have much more expertise on this than myself. And we've already heard some very good presentations on that. And then also here, recommendations on appropriate actions to ensure adoption and adherence to this. And I think this is where I'm going to focus most of my time. Because I'm going to make the argument that, thanks in large part to many people in this room, we know the guidelines of biomarker development. But why aren't they always followed is an important question. So my thoughts are, as I just said, right, the guidelines for development are known and published many times. Again, people in this room have made significant contributions to this. The issue is, why aren't these always followed? And therefore, I think a goal of this committee is to figure out why they're not followed. This is the responsibility of investigators, journals, clinical trials groups, and universities, right? And so I think we have to address it at multiple levels. So getting back to our research. Again, over the years, we've published now many papers on the intrinsic subtypes of breast cancers. I'll again stress, this is all in the research setting. This is all really exploratory, what I'll show you. And the subtypes are highly prognostic. I'll show you some of the potential validation of their prognostic abilities. But I'm going to start with this paper in 2003. Because this actually might represent one of the first across-platform papers published, where we took data sets generated by others, actually from Joe Nevins and from Laura Vandeveer, which were in the public domain. We applied our gene set and classification methodology, which in this case was hierarchical clustering, and what we could see was that our basic subtypes of luminal and basal and HER2-enriched were present on these other data sets, right? So This was exciting to us, and I think exciting to others at the time, because we were able to take data from different microarray platforms and basically find the same overall signatures, right? And so this sort of opened up the world for these across-platform analyses, which are also technically difficult at times because you have different probes measuring the same gene on different technologies. So over the years, I've been involved in the development of statistical tools for normalizing different microarray data sets to each other, again, done by my statistical colleagues at UNC. But one point I'll make is that this is a great tool for the research setting. I don't know how applicable it is to the clinical setting, because we're not going to be normalizing data together to then make a clinical decision. In the clinical setting, it's almost always on one platform, right? And so many of these issues, I guess, could be relevant, but if it's all on one technology, then we don't have to worry about normalizing one data set to another. So the other comment I'll make is the reproducibility of microarrays is well documented. And if you want to see about it, go to these many, many publications on it, including consortiums who have been formed to actually test how reproducible microarrays are. And I will argue that when performed in trained laboratories with provided reagents, arrays are as reproducible as any technology there is. And highly reproducible, and probably better than others because of the fact that we can measure so many analytes, we can measure dominant biology over and over again, and that redundancy is quite helpful in classification. So, of course, I have to show some anecdotal examples from our own work, right? And here we have the same tumor sampled, assayed twice, about 4 years apart. It's actually on two different versions of the same microarray. We made two RNA preps, and we actually used two different microarray scanners. And if we use all genes and look at an interclass correlation, there's a very high agreement. If we actually limit it to our classification set, this intrinsic gene set, the classification, the concordance actually goes up, right? So again, I'm going to argue this is a highly reproducible and robust technology when properly performed. So here is sort of the latest version of our assay. We had a paper in the JCO. Our assay now is a 55-gene assay, in this case scored by quantitative PCR. And the readout is going to be we assign you to one of five groups. And then we also can give you this this risk of relapse score, where the score is gives you a probability of relapse at 5 years. So you get two numbers. Well, you get a class and you get a number. Now, Steve will talk about this, I imagine. What is the clinical utility of this? I'll just show you a little bit of the data about prognosis. We can argue about how important prognosis is, but again, you have to demonstrate that in the presence of the old markers, this adds values. That's what this multivariable suggests. And then here was an interesting exercise where we actually compared our signature to multiple other signatures in this multivariable analysis using the NKI 295 sample set. Again, this is microarrays. Here's our subtypes. Actually, here's a research version of MammaPrint, and I'm going to say a research version of Oncotype DX, right? And you can look to see who's significant in the multivariable test, and the answer is it's pathology variables, and it's a couple of the signatures. Now, Oncotype DX didn't make it. It did perform well, but this is clearly a suboptimal implementation of this test. We didn't run the actual test, right? We made a microarray version of it. And I hope that the general audience can appreciate that this wasn't the real test. I think if we ran the real test, it would probably perform better. But nonetheless, if we do backward selection and come up with the final list of variables, again, it's a combination of subtypes, MammaPrint, and actually this other signature we developed, and then things like treatment matters, of course, and tumor size. But, you know, this also shows multiple signatures can make the final model. It's not just going to be one signature. And just, you know, some research means of assessing how helpful the test may be. So here is some simple validation. So as part of our NCI Specs grant, where we received funds to develop this intrinsic subtyping assay, we're looking at the performance of the assay in two different research laboratories, Matt Ellis at WashU and Phil Bernard at the University of Utah, where we assayed 83 samples. There was very high concordance in sample classification, and even a better correlation for this this risk score. So technically speaking, in two research laboratories, it's a highly reproducible test. Now, one thing I hope to point out in this talk is we need a level playing field here when we're evaluating all these tests. So here was a publication that just came out on pathologic grading with pathologists, right, which is used to make therapeutic decisions for breast cancer patients today, right? If we look at these, so we have 600 pathologists. In this case, we have 21. These Kappa values are in this 0.53 range. And their conclusion was, this is a good test. We should use it to make therapeutic decisions, and they are, okay? If I came to the table with a test with this Kappa value today, it wouldn't make it. But here is one of the current standards in clinical practice. So let's keep this in mind as we're evaluating the new tests. Now, in 2003, I wrote an editorial, actually on one of Joe Nevin's early paper on metagene predictors. And actually, this got me talking with David Ranzehoff, who's also at my university, and I soon became aware of David's rich history of writing about biomarker validation and development. And I became aware that David's been writing about this since at least 1978. So again, there is a very extensive literature on this topic. And again, here is some of the more extensive literature, right? So here's the paper from that Dr. Simon talked about, the two he talked about, one from Dan Sargent, another from David. So I think there is good publications on how to approach the problem. So I thought I would spend some time on some recommendations. So first, for authors, And I've been a proponent of this for a very long time, right? All the data should be made available at the time of publication such that others can reproduce the main findings of the paper, right? I mean, this is the basic scientific tenet of publication. And most of the time it's followed, but sometimes it's not, right? And again, I published a paper in an editorial on this on 2001. I think this was 2009, and then very recently, I think I signed this letter, Keith, that you had in Nature, but you had to like surf to three different websites to figure that out. But nonetheless, it's the same basic concept as this, right? Make the data available so that others can look at it and evaluate it. And I think this is a very good means of getting signatures evaluated objectively and quickly. For journals, I'm going to say if authors don't abide by that and the paper is published, the journal should threaten to retract the paper, right? I mean, I don't know how many times I've contacted journals and said, oh, this, you know, these authors didn't make something available, and they're like, oh, well, okay, and then nothing happens. Now, the key issue here is, and I'll also suggest that journals, when issues arise for specific papers, they should do some investigation on their own. But it's hard to say what is a legitimate issue, right? What versus, you know, scientific squabble versus a potential true confounding issue figured out, right? That is hard. I'm not quite sure how that distinction will be made. However, I do think journals should evaluate some of these papers that occur in their own journal as opposed to letting it work out in the literature. So let me just bring up another example here, using my own work as the poster child. So here was that paper I showed you earlier about our intrinsic subtyping assay. Well, we have an IHC version of it as well. And I had back-to-back papers in the JCO on this very topic. So in essence, it's the same biomarker. The genomics paper, we submitted 200 microarrays to the gene expression omnibus, qPCR data for about 400 samples, and all the clinical data that we used here such that anyone could reproduce what we did. For this paper, nothing was submitted, right? No clinical data, no IHC data, no nothing. It's not a level playing field, right? So for me, this discussion is not about omics or genomics. It's about biomarker research. And it should be the same rules that are applied, whether it's microarrays, immunohistochemistry, qPCR, copy number, sequencing, right? You think we're having problems with microarrays. Wait till all the sequencing data starts to hit the world. Many places can't even house that data, right? So we don't even know how to get that data into the public domain in some cases. But we need to be thinking about that. Clinical trial groups, right, and funding agencies need to thoroughly evaluate the markers that go into the clinical studies, right? I think this is happening the huge majority of the time, right? Integral biomarkers, and these are basically biomarkers in studies used to make patient randomization decisions, must meet the highest standards and have demonstrated technical reproducibility, right? This was talked about earlier. Even integrated biomarkers, those in studies, but not being used to make patient decisions, still also have to have a very high standard, certainly of technical reproducibility and likely clinical utility. So these are some specific terms here. There's a beautiful topic, a paper describing these terms. I think it came out last year. So here we're actually three of these studies run at Duke for the genomic predictors. These were integral biomarkers, right? They were randomizing patients based on this. I think after what we heard from Dr. Simon, these could have easily been the stratification design, where they were their integrated biomarkers, right? Which I do think is a better design. So one thing I'll say about universities, and I even see this happening in my own university with our own work, right? We must be transparent and objective in evaluating the discoveries of the scientists. And in preparing for this talk, right, figuring out what my conflict of interest is certainly suggests to me my universities are conflicted on many of these as well, right? They're the patent holders for these things. They're running the trials for these things. The huge majority of time, they're doing a great job, but occasionally, right, we need groups like this to evaluate the bigger picture. So I'll end just by thanking the many friends and colleagues who I've had great discussions with about biomarker research, and finish and take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's start with Kathy.
I think your recommendation about making data available is very noble. And as it relates, I'll only speak on the side of a journal. I wouldn't know what to do with it. I don't have the time or the resources to analyze it, so I do something a little different. I'm the only journal that requires, and I get into a lot of trouble because of this, that the data analysis must be done by someone with the faculty appointment who is functioning as a faculty member when that is done. Now, people misunderstand why I do that. It's not because I think that non-faculty biostatisticians are any lesser in any fashion than others. It's because if someone questions the veracity of the data analysis, I do what I have done four times. Not with a statistician, fortunately, but with others. I pick up the phone, I call the dean, And I asked the dean to do what I used to do when I was the vice dean at Hopkins, and that is establish a committee to look at the basic data. And very frequently with clinical trials, it involves patient information, and we don't want to get into the HIPAA rules, okay? So they do this, and I can tell you that I have only, thank God, retracted one paper in almost 12 years. It came out of China, and the only reason I was able to do it was because the dean was trained partially in the West. It took him a year to investigate, and it turned out that the data was wrong. So what I'm saying is, I think you're right. You just
let me hit on a comment which I didn't make here, right? So journals have a duty, but I don't think it's the journal or reviewer's duty to redo every analysis in every paper. It is just not practical,
Well, that's
possible,
what I'm saying,
right?
But I'm telling you what we do.
So it sounds like
I can't get any other journal to join me in doing that.
Keep pushing, please, and I'll support it.
If I could point out, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute does have a requirement for microarray data. It's very similar to the Nature Journal's requirement that at the time of submission of the paper, you either have to have the microarray data or sequencing data or any high dimensional data either archived in a public repository like GEO and the data has to be available for the reviewers should the reviewers want to look at it.
Okay, we have several hands.
Can I just add that the policy is the same for all of the science journals?
Sorry to jump in.
But I will point out it's not the same for most of the clinical journals.
But even if
right, and that's where the rubber hits the road.
But even if it's the same, there was a recent analysis done and only about 30% of the studies in journals where the data was supposed to be deposited is actually deposited. And the other problem is that in many cases, when the data is deposited, the ancillary data you need to go back and reanalyze it often isn't there. So the adherence to the policy is not complete, and people generally live up to the barest minimum of standards. And I think that's – I applaud you for addressing this, Chuck. I mean, this is something that I think really this committee has to get behind, is the availability of all of the data in a format that can be used.
Okay. David, just before I got Joe first, and then you and – John already spoke. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Chuck, this is a question of technical practicality. So you talked about going forward to massively parallel sequencing, which I think is where a lot of our enterprise is going to end up in a few years. And as you appreciate, we're not actually keeping the primary data.
That's right.
Not logistically possible to keep the primary data anymore, so it's processed and dumped. And so what's your recommendation in that context? I mean, we are, I think as we go forward, the practicality of the matter is that we're going to be dealing with more and more deeply derived data rather than the primary data itself. So we're on a slippery slope here. I'm curious as to what your recommendation is.
I mean, some version of these data has to be kept somewhere, right? And for... whether it's whatever the FASTQ files or the mapped files or something like that, we have to figure out how to store this. I mean, it comes down to money, right? This is a huge amount of data. It requires computing infrastructure and storage space and money, and we're generating more data than we can store. And so, I think those paying to generate the data need to consider housing the data in the budget for paying for it. Right? It might mean we generate less data, but we got to keep what we have.
The point that I'm getting to, I guess, here is that since we can't store the primary data, we're going to have to move away from this it all has to be out there concept, and we're going to have to move to some sort of a community standard as to what is storable and what, you know, what is the criterion for the derivation of the data that we ultimately end up storing. And I don't see that those standards are necessarily being developed at this point.
David. I would definitely agree. I mean, what is stored, it varies depending on the platform and the technology, and the experts will have to figure out what's appropriate for the next-gen sequencing data.
Chuck, this is a topic that's going to get discussed later with responsible parties, but could you say more about problem number one, make the data available when the data get challenged? I can't understand the data. They don't give the same results as what somebody else on the outside says. Do you as an investigator have any suggestions for how that ought to be adjudicated? Kathy has said she pulls the trigger and calls a dean and gets the university biostatistician to do it. Not all papers have a biostatistician. Should there be a low threshold for doing that? Should the journals have, are there other ways to do this, or is this immediately going to become some big contentious thing? Do you have any thoughts as an investigator about how to manage this fairly?
That's a tough question. I mean, usually, like I said, this is where it's difficult deciding between whether it's scientific squabble or there's some systematic flaw, right? And I would hope,
regardless of whether it's a squabble or something worse, you know, we want to know how Mother Nature works. There's something confusing here. How do we resolve that?
I mean, I actually don't know where I would go. Right? I think the first place I usually would go to is the journal. But beyond that, I don't know if there's a clearinghouse or somewhere to discuss these types of issues. I mean, I'm going to defer to Keith on this one.
We'll hear interesting things from his slides about what the reaction of journals was and where the problems are there.
I mean, if the journals.
But long before it gets to the journals, the most of this is a team science, as your multi-author papers indicate. Every member who puts his or her name on the journal article has a responsibility, and it ought to begin with making sure those who are members of the team understand what each other is doing, and hopefully each specialist in the team could present and explain to her colleagues what's been done and what's been found. To ask strangers to figure it all out later is a little more difficult.
You would hope, and presumably that's been done most of the time. But John knows this, right? A lot of times people will get array data sets and go, "Oh, I can't redo exactly what you did, but I'm 90% of the way there." So I would call that one a scientific squabble and something that shouldn't raise to the level of anything but a squabble. But if you just flat can't reproduce the result, there's almost no way to sort of make that known.
Okay, we got a lot of hands up.
I guess I hit a good topic.
let's do a quick run, and then I want to make sure our next speaker has her chance, and then we'll have plenty of time for further discussion. So I have Bill, Nathan, Laura, and Peter. Oh, welcome. Great to see you. Okay, Bill.
Yeah, you touched a little bit upon reviewers. Just wanted your thoughts on expanding the role of reviewers in terms of reviewing the papers and trying to determine the legitimacy of the claims of the paper. You know, how much time does a reviewer actually have to do that, and then what's the responsibility?
Another good question. I mean, when I review a paper, I spend 5, 6, 7 hours doing it, right? And that's not even trying to redo some of the analyses, right? I think most reviewers do a good job and try and be thorough, but I get to this point here. A reviewer or the journal can't redo everything in some of these papers. I mean, I just submitted a paper which it would take weeks of one really well-trained person to go through and redo what we did. And so I think, as many of these journals do, right, you've got sort of disease experts and then a statistician who looks at the methods and sees if they're sound. Now, you know, I think a question we're all wrestling with is should that statistician actually go in and start to redo some of these analyses? Maybe a few, but it's probably too much to ask them to do most.
And it may matter how important the conclusions are and what the applications are. Nathan?
I mean, I think if it's, you know, they're suggesting that the next study after this paper is going to be used for clinical randomization, then maybe you want to go in and look at it extremely closely, right?
So I just wanted to come back to the point that Joe was making before where, you know, with sequencing data where we really can't store all the raw data. And I was at the Genome Institute for Singapore recently, and I know Ed Liu and the people out there basically have decided that the way to store this data is actually to store the actual sample, that it's much cheaper to just take the sample and resequence the whole thing than it is to store the memory. And this is actually what the big genome centers are mostly doing. So in our recommendations for data storage, we may actually have to address the issues of, you know, do you have to make sample available, as that's actually the repository for data.
There's no way we're going to make the samples available, right? You'd have to sign an MTA with every university to get them around. Actually, I don't know if I buy that argument, right? I mean, it is
that is exactly what they are doing. I can just tell you that's most of the big genome institutes.
I wouldn't recommend that, but I also want to say, right?
Anyway,
Chuck, let's just hear the comment.
All right.
Yeah, if I can jump in really quickly, what your comment raises is the fact that there could be things that happened that you have no way of detecting from just looking at the data. Even if you had perfectly collected the data, if you had done something stupid like run all of the, you know, normal samples in one laboratory batch and run all of the, you know, cancer samples in another, you could perfectly give me that data. But unless I rerun the experiment, I will never know what the fatal flaw is in that experiment.
Okay. Laura.
So maybe a comment on verification of data, and actually fully agree that it's impossible for journals to do that because it's far too complicated. I think it's the responsibility, of course, first of all, of the authors. And I think in critical publications that I've been involved in on MammaPrint, we had preset protocols where an external party is validating, based on the raw data, the readouts of the MammaPrint. And also for our large clinical trial MINDEC, that is already built in, so that we know that there is a verification on that level as well, including also maybe data for ancillary research on the whole genome arrays, where I'm actually got very nervous about how to manage all that data. So I also now engage an external party to validate for me that what we have as raw and normalized data is actually correct. So I think it's more the responsibility for the authors, maybe not for all papers because it's just undoable, but if there are publications where this is a real crucial step in moving such signatures forward, I mean, you need to have an external validation of your own bioinformatics work.
This is really hard, guys, ladies and guys. Please make a note of your comment because I've got five more hands up. And we've got a speaker who hasn't been heard from yet. He's going to touch on some of the same things, I'm sure. So please make a note. We do have scheduled all the way to 11 o'clock. So we have time to discuss this extensively. And I think we need to give her a chance. Okay?